The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to We the People Talk Radio. You're joining Elizabeth Woodward, Aaron Ryan, and Bob Martin, our sound engineer. Another Sunday morning bringing you all things related to fiscal responsibility, limited government, and adherence to the Constitution.
We have to call it We the People Talk Radio now, you know.
What did I call it?
You called it We the People Talk Radio.
Oh.
As opposed to like singing radio, like that time that we sang, you know,
yeah.
All the Golden California,
yeah.
And then, you know, people are like, what?
Yeah.
Hey,
we'd love to hear from you, so give us a call at 530-605-4567. We're streaming live and chatting at wethepeopleradio.us.
Elizabeth's always got her little spiel.
I do. If I don't get it out right away, I'm going to screw it up.
I like breaking your train of thought. See how good you're doing this morning.
I didn't sleep a lot last night.
I didn't either.
I was awake almost the whole night. My dog kept getting up and going to the window every 5 minutes to see what was out there.
Gosh, maybe you should get your dog a night job. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, I'm thinking about it.
I think the weather's got the dogs kind of freaked out or something today.
Yeah.
Our groomer was sick, and so they didn't get their hair cut for like 3 months. So all summer they've been bushy like bears. And yesterday they got all their hair shaved off, and today it's going to be 70.
Oh,
that's going to be a bad day at Black Rock at our house. Oops. Hey, so it was a busy week. Busy week in the land of politics.
We had
a nice little debate. And, you know, just in case, Bob, do we have our soundbite, our favorite soundbite up?
Oh, we'll get it up here in just a moment.
Okay. Yeah, because just in case you guys haven't been following that whole thing with the president's website, you know, where if you hear anything negative about him, is it just about him or is it everything?
I think it's pretty much him.
It's just mostly him. If you hear anything negative about him, You're supposed to rat that out. Actually, you're supposed to go fact check it. That's what they say. Go fact check it. See, so if you see anything like that, you're supposed to fact check it with this special website.
Attack Watch.
And you know what's funny is that
Attack Watch.
They came out with that and everybody started poking fun at it right away.
Exactly.
People are just rolling on the floor laughing.
Yeah, that clip comes from the video that makes fun of it. I guess is it on YouTube, Bob?
That's from the YouTube video.
Yeah, so if you go to YouTube and you put in Attack Watch, you'll be able to see the video.
Attack Watch.
They make it all sinister and everything. So anyway, Bob found the clip. He isolated it. We didn't want to, you know.
We
didn't want to just let that blow by.
I think our current president does not like to get his feelings hurt.
No, and you know that whole $16 muffin scandal. I mean, there's a lot going on. That is a hot seat these days.
A lot locally too.
I know, tons of stuff. Okay, what'd you do this week?
Well, this week, I went to the Board of Supervisors meeting and the City Council meeting, both of which involved the Forest Service. In a nutshell, there is a thing called coordination, and coordination is actually the legal term and the legal process that mandates that federal agencies work with local jurisdictions, municipalities, local governments, if these federal agencies are going to do anything that's going to impact the quality of lives or, more importantly, the economy of that community. In other words, the feds can't just swoop in and do whatever they want and destroy your economy and your community and then walk away. They have to work with the local governments, and it's not just we'll talk to you and then we'll do what we want anyway. It literally is both sides get to come to the table, they have equal footing, and the decision that's reached must agree with both sides.
And it has to include people.
Right.
Which is a novel idea, you know, that we would include people in the decision making rather than just the fish.
So we had Sharon Haywood, who is she manages the Shasta Trinity National Forest. She oversees you know, what, 1.5 million acres or whatever it is. And so she came to both of those meetings and gave her presentation. And then there is a group of people that have formed a committee locally in Shasta County, many of whom are literal experts when it comes to the forest roads and what happens in the Shasta Trinity National Forest. They gave a counter presentation and encouraged both entities, the City Council and the Board of Supervisors, not only to invoke coordination but to implement it.
Absolutely, because her idea of a perfect world is a world where the public doesn't get to use the forest.
Yeah, no people are on it.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, of course, in public meetings and stuff, there will be some pushback on that might be an extreme characterization. However, when you look at what's actually happening,
yeah,
I had somebody tell me they were, I knew where it was at the time, but anyway, they were somewhere in the Shasta Trinity National Forest, and there were bulldozers working to dump gigantic, you know, half of a hillside down over a perfectly good road to decommission it.
Mm-hmm.
Because for the folks that think decommissioning means we just don't use it anymore because it's old, that's not actually true. That means they go rip it up so that it's impossible for us to use.
And I just want people to know, no matter where you're at, coordination is your way to sit at the table with the federal agencies. And there's like 25 agencies that are impacted by coordination and required to use it. And anyone, any elected group can invoke coordination. It can be a school board. It can be a water district, a fire district. It does not have to be your Board of Supervisors or your City Council. Ideally, it would be one of those. But it can be any elected body.
Yeah.
Anybody.
And it can actually be Native Americans with a tribal number, too.
Yeah.
So there are lots of ways to go about it, but it's kind of time for we the people to exercise their constitutional rights, and that would be one of them. So this morning we're talking about the coho salmon here going forward, and we will be talking with John Menke, who is really one of the guys up in the Scott Valley who has educated me greatly on that particular topic. And there are lots of misnomers about the fish. We've seen several articles in the Record Searchlight about dam removal. And whenever you talk about removing the Klamath dams, you talk about the coho salmon, because that's, you know, apparently the excuse for taking the dams out. So knowledge about the coho salmon and what's true and what's fictional and what's kind of a half-truth, that's kind of important for all of us, because we can't wage a coherent argument, obviously, without the facts. So we're going to take an early break here, then we'll come back with Dr. Menke so that we have a little more time, because those of you who have listened to John before know that he has more information than we have time. So you'll be back with We the People Radio. In the meantime, please go to the webpage, wethepeopleradio.us, and pull up a lot of the information we have there. I've included some pictures of fish screens and some of the other things we'll be talking about. So if you happen to be near a computer while you're listening, or on the computer while you're listening, go there and check out some of the things there. We'll be referring to those in just a little bit. Be back with you in a couple of minutes here at KCNR 1460, the home of Free Fire Media.
That justice is one thing. Always find you gotta saddle up your boys, you gotta draw a hard line.
When the gun smoke settles, we'll sing a victory tune, and we'll all meet back at the local saloon.
We'll raise up our glasses against evil forces, singing whiskey for my men, beer for my horses.
Join the conversation in our chat room, KCNR1460.com.
I see the moon rising. I see trouble on the way. I see earthquakes and lightning. I see bad times today. Don't go around tonight.
Welcome back to We the People Radio. We are going to be speaking with John Menke in just a moment about the coho salmon. But, you know, I just wanted to say one thing. We are very fast approaching our first anniversary. Almost a year ago today, we had our first show.
Also, probably a year ago today, Carl Bott said, hey, wouldn't it be fun to do a show called We the People? And we said, sure.
And he said,
and he goes, well, hey, why don't you guys be on it? And we're like, because we don't know how to do radio.
and then we said, when do you want us to do it? And he goes, well, right now. So I think next week is the 1 year anniversary.
Yeah, it's been fun, too.
It has been.
It's been very fun. We've been making friends all over the place. Elizabeth made friends with somebody in Southern California who's been listening to the program,
yeah,
who wants us to come on their program. It's like, well, looky there.
Yeah.
Going to be able to get this information out,
you know,
after all.
It's taken a while, but people are really starting to listen all over. They're finding out.
Mm-hmm. I would encourage you to email these programs. That's why Robert does such a great job,
yeah,
with the website. WeThePeopleRadio.us has the archives for the past year or so. All those shows, any show you click on, you can actually listen to again. The sound files there has all the supporting information, and you can email that link. You can actually even order a CD right there online if you don't have the bandwidth to listen through your computer.
And, you know, Rob...
Trying to make it easy. You know?
Robert's been a great asset to the show, too, and I know he's gotten really busy. He's he's very talented, and he's become very popular with a lot of people that appreciate what he's able to do for them, and it's all grassroots. So
yeah, isn't that fun? I remember when he first came to the Tea Party, he's like, what am I going to do? I'm an artist. It's like, I don't know, we'll figure something out.
Yeah, it's been
a good
year.
Look at him now. He's running around like a maniac. So if you do have an odd skill, we're dying to meet you.
Yeah.
All right, so we've got Dr. John Mankey on the phone with us. John, are you in there?
Hello, hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, how's it going?
Well, I'm quite happy this morning. We got about three hundredths of an inch of rain overnight, and it's about 57 degrees, and the oak trees are starting to turn brown, so the transpirational demand of water is going to decline. So I think the streams will start coming up, and maybe the salmon won't get caught like a lot of the enviros were hoping for.
And which, a.k.a. the farmers and ranchers won't be hung by the thumbs.
Yeah, well, about a week ago, we had an alert from a Karuk tribal leader person, Tao Soto, indicating that down the Scott River, downstream from the Scott, the salmon were all nosing into the little tributary streams, not the Scott itself, but the other small streams right off the Klamath. These fish were gulping for cold water, and things were tough down there. And since we had... Back at the end of the August, we learned about the pulsing of the Trinity. We knew they falsely triggered a bunch of salmon again this year, and they were getting a setup for another big fish kill. But it so far it hasn't taken place, so that makes us feel relieved. And now the weather is cooling off, and in fact we're going to be in the high 30s, I think, tomorrow morning, and that'll keep the water cold, and so the dissolved oxygen issue will decline, and the fish will be in better shape, and we won't have another crisis.
But, you know, rumor has it that if they are a little short on coho salmon, you can always make a run to Costco.
Yep, yep.
Yeah, we're still...
Yeah, we had a picture from a market somewhere at the fair this year, at the Siskiyou Golden Fair in Wairika, that showed you could buy it for $12.49 a pound. I don't know where the restaurant was, but it was kind of a clever photo.
They had it at Costco literally 2.5 weeks ago.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I, the fish and game guy, well, when I was talking to a couple of them, and they were talking about, you know, filing these, you know, these cases about the fish being killed and this and that. And I'm like, gosh, you know, it is just so hard to get worked up over that when they're in Costco.
Yeah.
So... You know what? Give folks a thumbnail sketch of your background, just for the people who didn't hear when you were on before.
I grew up in Sacramento and went to American River Junior College. Took a lot of mathematics there. Thought I was going to become a mathematician. Went over to Davis. UC Davis was disappointed with the math program, and I just worked on a ranch up in northern Nevada, up in Paradise Valley, and which my father had arranged for me to go up there and maybe learn how to become a rancher. And so when I came back and after my first year at Davis, talked to my father, and I said, I sure disappointed the math program over here compared to American River Junior College. He says, why don't you go into range management? And I didn't realize they were trying to fix me up with a daughter of one of the cousins of the main rancher up in Paradise Valley. I didn't hit it off with her, so I wasn't interested in girls at the time. So I went ahead, we got into range management, and Bill Williams over at Davis was so enthralled with all this guy coming in, wanted to study range management. He got all this mathematics training. He says, you could go places in modeling. Anyway, he became my mentor, kind of, and encouraged me to do a master's at Davis, and then after I finished my bachelor's, and he said, you ought to apply to graduate school. So I applied to Colorado State, Utah State, Oregon State, got accepted all places. They liked people with all that kind of training, and went to Colorado, became a systems ecologist during the heyday of the International Grassland Biome Program, a big National Science Foundation program. It was a great stimulus for me because there were 40 PhD students there studying grasslands, and that's where I met Paul Risser from Oklahoma, who became president of Oregon State and a big player in the issues we're talking about here, because he chaired a very important 2008 National Research Council study of the flows in the Klamath River. So we kind of rekindled our communications recently. And anyway, then I when I finished at Colorado, I applied for a job at Berkeley in the forestry and conservation school of forestry and conservation. And my wife and I, we moved down there. We got married in 69, so we've been married 42 years. And we, after being in Colorado, we came back out to Berkeley. And that was a little bit of a shocker, having grown up in Sacramento area around Davis. And so
yeah, I'll bet.
After about 5 years of that, I had enough of that. So we applied for a job that came open in range over at Davis. And when I got that, I resigned my position at Berkeley and went over to Davis. So I was at Berkeley as a professor, assistant professor for 5 years, and then went to Davis and went from assistant through full professor in 20 years. And then through a combination of things, primarily fish and game biologist up here in Wairika asked me to come up and supervise, if I would, a student's thesis work here in the Marble Mountains. And I'd never been to Siskiyou County before other than just going through on Interstate 5, and fell in love with the place. And my wife and I, we made a lowball offer on a very nice ranch, which I'm sitting on right now, and we ended up getting it for a song and in 1993. And so we bought it and decided to retire in 1998. I did an intergovernmental personnel agreement with the Klamath National Forest from 92 through 98, where they reimbursed the University of California, Davis, for my salary. And I helped them get all their GIS and computer modeling skills to try and deal with the spotted owl. But Al Gore and Bill Clinton beat us. And so we're back at that again now a little bit. We're starting to worry about forest upland management here. So as soon as we get this fish on the back burner, we're going to start working on uplands here to begin to manage upland forests like they should be. California is in dire need of improved management of its upland resources for increased water supply for the people and the fish, and that's where we're going next.
Well, I think that's that qualifies you to talk about this, doesn't it?
Sounds like it to me.
That's the part that's so frustrating. So many of the things that we read in the newspaper and in these studies and things, I know that some of these people don't even have the level of qualification of many of the people up in the valley up there. So we kind of promised people today that we would talk about the coho salmon and kind of do a fact versus fiction. I think we've read enough of the fiction, but you and I talked about some high points, really things that are confusing for people, things that have been misstated so often that a lot of folks without further study would not know the difference. Where would you like to start?
Well, I did a little bit more definition checking since we talked about today's show, and got into a little bit of the issues of indigenous, endemic, nativeness, things like that. And I think it would be useful for us to deal with that typing of the salmon a little bit, so that we have an accurate representation of the species we're dealing with. So I did some work on the internet to get myself fully understanding these different terms. Normally, my experience in these issues dealt with plants, because I mainly am a grazing expert on terrestrial plants. And so normally what we deal with is native versus non-native in plants. And that relates to invasive species. Most of California grasslands, for example, are heavily invaded by plants from Spain. Because the Spanish settled here, and when they brought their animals over here to California and the West Coast, they had a lot of plants in the bedding and food in their ships. And so largely the grasslands of California are non-native dominated. And so when you look into a flora or the taxonomy of the plants of California, and you look in the grasses section, the vast majority of the plants are non-native. They're all from Spain, southern France, North Africa, the Mediterranean region over in that part of the world, because that's called the Old World, because the people here came from that, from Europe. And so now when you get to the salmon or the peoples here today, it's interesting to talk about a term called indigenous. And that's a term that my colleagues that work on a couple of the groups we're working with here, the Siskiyou County Water Users Association and the Scott Valley Protect Our Water Group, particularly Richard Gerak, a chiropractor who lives over on the river and has for a long time. He's done some of the most research on this issue, and he says the coho is not indigenous. That actually is correct. Indigenous really means the original inhabitants, and it can be applied to animals, plants, people, or whatever. And so what we have here are today, because the original coho salmon that were here were fished out for what there were here, about 1900, the record shows, and this is actually in fishing game or pre-fishing game studies, that by 1900, a cannery down at near the town of Klamath, at the estuary of the Klamath, the fishery was so exploited that the runs of all salmon up the Klamath River were basically extirpated. They were gone because the canneries through netting in the estuary and the lower river removed all the fish. And so when you deal with coho in particular, there was a major effort from about 1895 to restock fish, because they could see that the exploitation prior to 1900 was becoming extreme. So there were hatchery efforts begun up around Klamathon, Oregon, here just above Interstate 5, where Interstate 5 crosses the Klamath River. And those efforts, particularly in the early 1900s, involved a planting of as many as 2.5 million coho a year for a number of years in there to try and get them reestablished. They did the same thing with Chinook. And, in fact, a lot of the Chinook in the Sacramento River were planted from up here, because there was a similar problem in of exploitation in the Sacramento River system. So many of the fish down by Redding today have as their descendants from fish from up here. But anyway, the coho then here were replanted, and was prior to Iron Gate Dam construction in 1962 that another three efforts were made, because those early efforts failed. And so in the early 60s or late 50s, up on Fall Creek, which we visited a couple of weeks ago, in fact you were there, Aaron, it's one of the power generation plants of PacifiCorp, there's a hatchery established there, and the eggs were taken from fish and taken over to Mount Shasta Fish Hatchery and grown out and replanted in the river. And only the third time were those was that planting successful, and that's basically what the fish we have today. Well, those fish came from Oregon, Cascadia, Oregon, and so they're not the original inhabitants. So the fish we have today were derived from those fish from Oregon, so they're not indigenous. However, because the coho used to be here, you could call it a native species, because these are colonizing species. Salmon, they can come and go, and recolonize an area. And once a bunch of females happen to come up a river and lay their eggs, the young from those fish, once they go to the ocean, they tend to come back to what's called their natal stream where they were raised. So you get recolonization. But the fish we have are not the original inhabitants. They're not indigenous.
Well, I think that is that's the one thing people hang their hat on. When we come back, I'd like you to tell folks how that relates to the Endangered Species Act. Holy cow,
sure.
We're right on track here, pretty much. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in 2 minutes here at We the People Radio with Dr. John Mankey. Grab a cup of coffee, and we'll see you in a couple. We're at KCNR 1460 AM, the home of Free Fire Media.
Line is open on KCNR 1460, 530-605-4567.
Progress came and took its toll.
Welcome back to We the People Talk Radio. We're speaking with John Mankey, Ph.D. from Siskiyou County, who's talking about the coho salmon and kind of telling us his history and dispelling the rumors and the myths and telling us the truth.
Exactly. So, okay, we've established the coho salmon is native, but not technically indigenous, exactly. But now, how does all that tangle up with the Endangered Species Act? Because a lot of people are saying that it doesn't apply.
Actually, it becomes very important because this is where man starts to get involved in the issue. Of course, the reason it's not indigenous is because man produced it by going and getting fish from out of the area and brought them in here because they didn't have them here to start with. So we basically have an import population of fish. Some people can call it maybe a metapopulation, which means that's a localized unit of a species. But things got really mixed up back in the early, late 80s is really when it began, because that's when the sucker fishes got listed in 1988 in the Upper Basin. And things started to move here, and for those of us that have been involved in resource management for a long time, the environmental movement and the passing of the National Environmental Policy Act in the late 60s, but around the early 70s, just about the time I went to Berkeley in 1973, there was some big NEPA laws passed that led to the Endangered Species Act. And up here, we have a very unusual situation where there appears to have been a planned effort to get the coho listed and use that as a device to begin to manipulate ownership of property and the rights of people. And this is why it's so interesting to be on your show, because the focus of your show is exactly that, and also all the financial issues related to it. So and the cost to the taxpayer and the concern about that, because that's what Tea Parties originally were, as we know. When the government starts to overtax the people rebel, and that's where we're at. Anyway, the endangered coho salmon, it was not endangered at all. As I said in an earlier broadcast, it's a ubiquitous species. It's a generalist species. It occurs all over the Pacific. Goes down as far as originally down as far as Santa Barbara, and all the way around, clear down to probably Korea, and all up in the Gulf of Alaska. In fact, the main fighting fish that fly fishermen go for in the streams are silver salmon or coho, up there in the Kenai Peninsula. I haven't been up there myself. I fished a lot in B.C., but that's the fighting fish up there. They aren't as big as the Chinook, but they're a lot more fun to catch. And because they aren't just big hogs, they fight like a trout, but they go up to 15, 20 pounds, and that's extremely exciting on a fly rod. So the sport fishing value is immense. So anyway, down here, I don't know. I don't really recognize these people and these agencies as being very bright on many of these subjects, but somebody must have been figuring out that if we could get this species listed, we'd have a real pry in here to begin to rewild the area. I knew Reed Noss up at Oregon State, who did the original wildlands map. And if those are not aware of it, I think you have it on your website there.
Yeah, we
and
do.
It shows the all of Siskiyou County as a wildlife corridor, which means that, well, there aren't supposed to be any people in here. This is just supposed to be for wildlife and fish and the natural flora of the area, the plants.
So you knew the guy who drew the map?
I have to think somebody was thinking about that back in the late 80s, yeah. And beginning to plan that. So there were, and Richard Gerak is more familiar with this, and so is the Grange outfit in Wairika, because the Greenhorn Grange got involved, and so did the local Farm Bureau, and so it's those outfits attempted to watch what the federal government was doing on planning of maybe listing this fish federally under the Endangered Species Act. And this is where they had to go to a metapopulation subset, because the species was so widespread, they had to localize it to the Northern California, Southern Oregon unit of the coho to take an isolated group. And this is, of course, centered around the Klamath River and the fish that inhabit this area. And this is such a big river, unusually big river system. It has an extremely unusual situation of a high phosphorus pollution situation. So the planners of the listing of this species may have known that this would be an ideal place to get a fish listed, because it would be a very hard place for this fish to ever do well. And so the lasting benefit of the listing would be tremendous, because you really will never be able to build a really large population, because the species, with its special need to summer rear for a whole year, or rear in fresh water for much longer than all the other salmon species, it would be the ideal species to get listed. So that must have been the motivation of segregating out a separate unit, the SONC, Southern Oregon, Northern California coastal population of coho. And they got it listed first, and then they lost the listing over, I think, the issue of whether or not they would count the fish that were raised at the hatchery or not. And that was an unfortunate situation, that they went around to several judges to finally get a ruling in the environmental favor and the federal government's favor that we shouldn't have to count the hatchery fish. And that way, all these fish that are being raised at Iron Gate would not be counted, and therefore it would keep the number on the count low, which would allow the listing to happen. So it's through a socio-political judicial process that allowed the fish to get listed, when in fact, as I talked on my first time, I talked with Frank Galusha on the MyOutdoorBuddy.com, which this station also broadcasts on Saturday morning each week. I talked about the nativeness and the requirements of a coho salmon, and people can click on that and hear that. But basically, this part of the river is so polluted, and it gets so warm, it's a warm water fishery, that it really is what we call the coho is maladapted for living in this environment. So what we're doing is we're chasing the impossible, and of course that's the ideal situation for a group of people that have an agenda, and we suspect it is Agenda 21 and rewilding. So the species never should have been listed. And the really bothersome part about this is now this has gotten to the stage where the government is having to even corrupt the science. And I've been in touch with Dr. Carlos Garza, He's out stationed out in Santa Cruz for National Marine Fisheries Service, probably an outstanding geneticist. And but he has been doing the genetics work on the this species, and I've seen the cladograms, which are diagrams that show the relatedness of different populations. And we suspect the research is already done, but my last conversation with Carlos on the phone was that he would not be releasing the report until after the first of the year. Department of Water Resources officials have told us that the report was done in November 2010. So we suspect that this this huge, actually, factor in dam removal of having the coho currently listed while Secretary of Interior Salazar is going to make a determination, it's critical that the fish is still listed. We suspect that the genetics work of Garza and others will show that, in fact, these are all a hodgepodge of fish that were introduced from various places outside this area, and they are not indigenous, and therefore they shouldn't be listed, and they may lose the listing status. And so we have people not even we could go to Freedom of Information Act, but we haven't bothered to grasp for such straws at this point. But we're just going to let it happen and see what Garza comes up with here after the first of the year. We're waiting with bated breath, actually, because they're probably,
no pun intended,
that they're holding back. They're probably looking at any way they can present that to favor the viewpoint that the fish should stay as a listed species. I'm very happy to be able to say that my wife is really a cytogenetics technician and worked with starch gels, potato starch gels originally, and then polyacrylamide gels with Sabot Jane, a professor at Davis. And so we fully understand the genetics and all the testing, even the new mitochondrial work that's being done on Native Americans. We're fully aware of that procedure, because actually those procedures are being used even in cattle breeding now. And so since we're cattle breeders, we stay fully up to date on the latest genetic methods. And so we're waiting to critique Carlos Garza and others' report when it comes out after the first of the year. And probably we will work with others to bring reason to the listing of this species, because as you can hear on my other broadcast, it's too hot in here in the summertime, except in very unusually cool water systems like we do here in Quartz Valley, with all the water we have out of the Marble Mountains. It is so cold that we can maintain some habitat here in Quartz Valley for coho salmon, but the majority of the range here in the Klamath River watershed, the water's too warm, and so it's trying to put a square peg in a round hole, and of course that's ideal, as I said, for the environmental people that want to rule, but we don't think false science should be allowed.
Exactly. And, you know, just to clarify, when you say that the river is polluted, that's a natural form of pollution. And for people who would like to know what exactly that means, go back to the program a couple of weeks ago. We'll give you the date when we come back. We're going to take a quick break here because it cuts us off at 9 o'clock, and we don't want to short out this next segment here. So we'll be right back with you in 2 minutes at We the People Radio. You're listening to KCNR 1460, the home of Free Fire Media.
If your tax advisor tells you your legal deductions are red flags, it's time for North State Consultants in Reading. Our team specializes in reducing your tax liability using IRS policies and administrative law. As the most aggressive and qualified tax preparation and audit litigation specialists in the business, we offer tax and trust assistance with audits, late filings, overdue taxes, and more. For more information, visit our website at northstateconsultants.com.
Join the conversation in our chat room, KCNR1460.com.
I'm going fish, 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 fish. fishing. I'm going fishing. Hook, sinker, and line. I said fish, 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 fishing. Boy, I'm going fishing just to ease my mind.
Going to Costco after the show to get my coho salmon ho. Welcome back to We the People Radio.
You can't say talk radio now that you've been singing again.
We are here with Mr. John Menke, PhD, foremost authority on all things biological.
He actually, in the Scott Valley, and don't contradict us, John, because that's our story and we're sticking to it.
He actually knows more than the other guys.
Well, he knows more than they've forgotten.
You know, it's funny you bring that up. I've been reflecting on my life recently as far as how much time I'm spending on this now. You know, it only took me 10 years to get a PhD. I've now been doing this study for 19. So I actually know a lot more about salmon and management of salmon than I know about grassland ecology, which I spent 10 years learning and teaching it for 25 years too. So it's a little shocking how a person can get wrapped up in the subject matter, but I'm actually finding it fascinating.
Well, I think for all of us
I think the next thing we ought to do is we ought to talk about what happened on the listing and then what's the result of that, because this is where it really gets sticky, and we start to have some real problems that we need to deal with. And in 1995, it looked like the coho was going to get listed by the federal government, and the National Marine Fisheries Service was pushing this quite hard at the time, and that effort by the local Farm Bureau and the Greenhorn Grange, because of the courts, they lost that stuff eventually. So that wasn't a very good effort, actually. It was a yeoman-level effort given the skills of what people had to work with, but they didn't have the biological training or the genetics understanding or what it takes to really fight that battle. So they got beat, and it's really a shame when you get beat in court. It's much better to be beat on biology. But anyway, so the fish did get listed by the federal government in 1997. But prior to that, the way the ESA process works is you, when it looks like some species of concern or whatever is heading toward listing, you have to start treating it like it was listed even before it gets listed. So in anticipation of listing in about 1997, in 1995, now realize that these are non-indigenous coho salmon that have been reared regularly, that is actually by Supreme Court order, since 1962 at Iron Gate Hatchery. So you've got a whole staff of people working every day over out there feeding these fish and taking the eggs and keeping them healthy and releasing them at the right time. They've been doing that since 1962, so we're not talking about a non-going program. These people have been doing that for more than 30 years in 1995. But anyway, in anticipation of listing, and here's where it gets really sticky. Federal government, working with Fish and Game, decided we better start marking all the coho salmon that we release from Iron Gate Hatchery. And interestingly enough, I don't know quite why, but they also decided they would start marking all the steelhead that they raise at Iron Gate Hatchery. And by treaty with Canada and Japan and I don't know who else, maybe Soviet Union at the time, they may have they were marking the Chinook, and that Chinook procedure involved putting the coated wire tag, that's what it's called, but actually it's a little inserted thing about the size of a pencil lead in the cartilage of the nose of the Chinook salmon. And cutting off the adipose fin, that little fin on the top of the upper part of the tail of the fish, so you could look and see whether that fin was gone when those fish returned in spawning, and that would give you a suspicion that there was a coat of wire tag in its nose. It also could allow fishermen to recognize whether or not they had to keep the head of that fish so that that coded wire tag, which has a unique number on it, could keep track of the fish. This treaty between nations was set up internationally to manage the fishing pressure on Chinook, which is the main species that is of importance to commercial and tribal and sport fishing interests. And so I think up until just a few years ago, they only put a coda wire tag in 3%. 3 out of 100 of the little fish before they release them, and they cut off the adipose fin. Recently, Fish and Game acquired a over $1 million machine out there at Iron Gate Hatchery that allows them to mark larger numbers of fish. And now I think they're marking 10% of the 5.1 million that they produce each year of Chinook. By the it got to be, I don't know the history of the battle, but I've seen the case. The Supreme Court got involved and ordered that Fish and Game will run a hatchery at Iron Gate and will raise 5.1 million Chinook every year, 75,000 coho. Realize that's a small number now compared to 5.1 million. And then 900,000 steelhead. So so in 1995, in anticipation of federally listing, they started to mark the steelhead and the coho. And this is where I've got to really rub now, rub with Fish and Game on the mark they chose. They're using scissors on 100%, or at least they're attempting to do 100% of every fingerling coho and every fingerling steelhead. Before they release them, they cut off the left maxillary bone of the mouth of the fish with a pair of scissors. Actually, they hired young people to help them do this job. In fact, Ray Halp, a friend of mine, had one of the students from COS who was doing that as a job out there before release of these fish, and they had quite a few young people to help them do this, and it really is kind of corny. They dump all these fish in a bin of water, put in some anesthetic, they grab the fish out, cut the left part of the upper jaw off of all the coho and steelhead, and then they dump them back in the water, and of course it probably doesn't feel too good. Because these fish, not only are they having a part of their body removed, the reason they cut the left part off is they're euphemistically saying that they took a left turn down at Wichipec. That means they stayed in the Klamath River and came up to Iron Gate, versus their other choice of making a right turn and going up the Trinity River there at Wichipec and going up the Lewiston Fish Hatchery. Supposedly those fish over there get their right upper jaw clipped off. Well, I've researched this quite thoroughly with the help of professional fish biologists from as far away as Bursar Island, Washington, to UC Davis, to Humboldt State. And I got a hold of a couple of publications that indicate that when you do that to a fish, they grow slower and they have increased mortality in the ocean. And those studies were done, the two that I have, they're old papers, one in 1964 and one in 1970. These are professional journal articles where fish were clipped this way and then studied to look at their performance after they were clipped. And this mark should not be being used on an endangered species.
Interestingly enough,
I realize we're getting close to the end of time here, yes. or 9 o'clock, but I've kind of reached this back to find out why they might be doing this, and I found out that David Hankin, the professor over at Humboldt State, doesn't like hatcheries. And most of the people in Fish and Game that I deal with are all graduates of Humboldt State. So I'm seeing a linkage even to training here that maybe these people would just as soon not have these fish that are being raised at Iron Gate Hatchery be too successful. Now, most of them do come back, or a lot of them that have this mark are seen in the mark on the returning spawners, but so few of them make it back, like normally less than 2%. I have to think that this is having a really a detrimental effect on both of these species, the coho and the steelhead.
All right, we'll come back with that in just 5 short minutes here. We're going to take a break for the news. You're listening to We the People Radio on KCNR here at the home of Free Fire Media.
The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
You are turning in...
Pumpkin.
You are turning into a pumpkin any day soon, and you're going to have your three white horses and your knight in shining armor. No, you are tuning into the second hour of We the People Radio with your hosts Elizabeth Woodward and Aaron Ryan and our great sound engineer Bob Martin.
Those 5-minute breaks are just a killer. We tried to record a 1-minute commercial. It took us 5 minutes to do it, and we didn't get it done. What the heck?
Glad to entertain. Now, what was it that you called us earlier, Bob? You called us the Sunday morning We the People Zoo?
This is turning into the We the People Morning Zoo. Yes.
Yeah, okay. The We the People Morning Zoo. I like that.
It's Sunday morning. You need a little jolt.
Yeah.
Well, we're happy to provide.
We've got the chat room open. That's the one benefit of listening to the program online. If you go to wethepeopleradio.us, you click on listen, it'll pop the chat room open if you're on between 8 and 10 Sunday morning. Otherwise, it'll play the archive of the program for you. So,
be forewarned, though, you might get kicked out.
Attack! Wow!
Careful what you say.
They kicked me out. They kicked Aaron out.
They kicked everybody out. It's not Attack Watch now. It's Attack Cut You Off. What the heck? They're everywhere. But they're here from the government, and they're here to help. So that's why we're going to return to Dr. John Behnke here and talk some more about the listing of species, which is, you know, it's funny. We all think that, well, I think most of us do, they list a species, and it's kind of like, I don't know. It's kind of like, let's have a sad day, you know? What a disaster. It's always a disaster for the people who live by wherever the thing is. So, you guys are the latest victims. The new spotted owl.
Yeah, when they list mosquitoes as an endangered species, we're all in trouble.
Exactly. Okay. So, okay. Let me clarify one thing. I have been told or read or heard or something, but I have this note here that the genetics work on the wild coho salmon versus the hatchery salmon is virtually indistinguishable. Fact or fiction?
Yeah, well, that's why they mark these fish. Is there are still coho that were not indigenous, but were in the river, and they are doing their own thing. Like over here in Scott Valley, where I live. When they survey for the number of fish that are spawning here and looking for the carcasses after the spawning, they check the mouth of the fish to see if they have been clipped, whether the maxillary clip has been removed or not, and only rarely do we find a clipped fish over here. So all the fish virtually that come up the Scott River are wild-reared fish. That doesn't mean they're indigenous. They still came from the planted populations, but they are not immediate origin from the planted fish at Iron Gate. So, likewise, at Iron Gate Hatchery, they do get some wild-reared fish returning that are really all technically strays because they were not reared there. But they get mixed up in this polluted river. The river stinks so much a lot of the time that they probably their ability to find their natal stream is not as good as in a river that is cleaner. But so there are unmarked fish that are returning to the hatchery every year. They're a very small percentage and becoming smaller all the time, which I think I understand why as well. But that marking business, the reason I'm so concerned about it is the study in 1964 and then the study in 1970. The 64 study was actually on Chinook, and Lisa Thompson at Davis found me through a Science Citation Index search on the 64 paper, and found that another researcher in 1970 actually did a study on coho. And, of course, that was my coup de grace to see an actual maxillary clipping study on Coe and be able to read the undesirable effects. So this is published research. This is dynamite because if and when we get into a real battle over this, we can just go right to the paper and say, why did you guys start clipping these fish? And if you link it back to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court order said you had to raise 75,000 Coe, not 75,000 Coe that have had their upper maxillary bone taken off. So they in effect are maiming these fish before they release them. And most importantly, though, from my perspective, is these are fish that have a cut surface on their mouth and they are in polluted water that naturally has a higher bacterial content. So these two papers in 64 and 70 that indicate damage, I am certain that the damage to the maxillary clip fish in this river is much, much, much more severe than it would be in cleaner water. So that probably explains why our return rates are so low. But this helps keep the fish listed because you can never recover it. If you keep clipping them, the chances of them being successful is much, much lower.
Well, they're basically maiming them,
right? We've got a real conundrum here because we've got a marking technique that allowed, probably because of Hankin and his disciples here, that they are more worried about the wild-reared fish than the fish they're raising. So they want to be able to distinguish them, but they ought to be marking them some other less affecting way on them. In fact, even the current hatchery manager says it's a gruesome process. He doesn't like doing it, but he's ordered to do it. And of course, he hires other people to help him do it to get it done quick. But these fish, I'm certain, are suffering because of the disease environment that they live in, which is all natural. So when they release them, these fish have still got another year to go in the fresh water. And when you release them at Iron Gate, there isn't much coho rearing habitat downstream because it's so warm. And so over here in Scott Valley, as you learned me talk last time, I think, we had a tremendous run this last year because these fish are not being maxillary clipped, and also the water conditions in Scott Valley is not polluted that by the phosphorus like it is in the Shasta. Of course, the Shasta cohort is just about done because that river is polluted just like the main stem Klamath because it also comes out of phosphorus-rich areas. I wanted to bring up a couple other points that are bothersome relative to coho salmon and hatchery management. I don't know how long ago it was, but when I'm looking at the Iron Gate hatchery sheet that you can pick up out of the hatchery, which has their production goals, and it lists the 5.1 million smolts of Chinook at the top, released in May and June. Then they list 900,000 yearling Chinook released in November. I want to get back to that. But then they list 75,000 yearling coho released in April and 200,000 yearling steelhead released in April. That was a red flag to me back in 2009 when I learned that they were raising Chinook salmon till they're a year old. Chinook are not supposed to be in fresh water when they're that old. So that was another big red flag to me that apparently somebody made a decision, let's keep some of these Chinook to an older age. So in 2009, Fish and Game got sued by the Center for Biodiversity on their hatchery programs statewide in California, focused particularly on planting trout in the Sierra Nevada mountain lakes, because it was perceived that the trout that were planted in these lakes were eating red and yellow-legged frog eggs in these lakes and causing those species to become endangered. So Fish and Game got in trouble over that by a lawsuit on them by Center for Biodiversity. Well, I commented on their EIR, EIS on hatchery operations, specifically with respect to Iron Gate hatchery management. And I, at that time, didn't talk at all about maxillary clipping. I talked about these older age Chinook that are being released that are likely going to eat all these little coho salmon that are in the river. And even the ones that come out of the Scott River, they go down and have to go through what I call a predation gauntlet as they are heading for the ocean with 900,000 well-fed yearling Chinook that were supposed to be in the ocean 6 months earlier. And so this choosing to raise that many yearling Chinook was creating predation pressure on an already hurting species that has their upper jaw of their mouths cut off almost 100% of before they get released. How in the world are you, if you can't swim straight because your body isn't balanced as well because you got one side cut, I did a big comment to the ERR EIS, and I CC'd it to my colleague Dr. Peter Moyle down at Davis, and we had good communication about it, and I got real to read it. Those darn fish are 3 to 6 to the pound of these Chinook they're releasing, and those Chinook that size are not supposed to be in fresh water, and I can tell you right now they must be eating a tremendous number of coho.
Well, go figure. This is almost like one of those bad jokes. It's like, okay, let's see, we've got this and this and this and this, but they're an endangered species. Good grief. Hey, John, if you'll email me that paper, we will put it on the website for people to access. So when they go back to this program, they can find it. We'll be back in 2 minutes here at We the People Radio. You're listening to KCNR 1460, the home of Free Fire Media.
If your tax advisor tells you your legal deductions are red flags, it's time for North State Consultants in Reading. Our team specializes in reducing your tax liability using IRS policies and administrative law. As the most aggressive and qualified tax preparation and audit litigation specialists in the business, we offer tax and trust assistance with audits, late filings, overdue taxes, and more. For more information, visit our website at northstateconsultants.com.
The hotline is open on KCNR 1460, 530-605-4567.
Drats. Foiled again. We had some good fish music for you, too.
Sometimes the computer just locks up.
Yeah, you can't have everything. We could do that little poem we know from when we were kids.
Which one's that?
Fishy, fishy in the brook. Daddy caught him with a hook. Mommy fried him in a pan, and baby eats him like a man. There you go. Talk radio at its finest.
Oh, man.
Bob's scurrying to get music for the next break. There you go, Bob. Let you be warned there. That's what we have waiting in our bag of tricks if you don't provide music for us.
Yeah, we're going to pull out old... We're going to come up with old nursery rhymes. Yeah,
that's exactly it.
Or we'll sing.
We could all sing Three Little Fishes.
I don't think I know that one. Is it like one little, two little, three little? Yeah. John, come back. Help us out here. We're floundering.
That sounds pretty good.
So to speak.
Actually, I like the analogies you guys are referring to here. What I learned from Peter Moyle, Dr. Peter Moyle down at Davis, was that he doesn't like hatcheries either particularly because they have some characteristics that... unfortunately, again, in the case of Iron Gate, even the Supreme Court ordered all this stuff to be done. But Peter told me, when you get these hatcheries so far from the ocean, like the one in there at Reading, or like the one up at Oroville on the Feather, or like the one on the American up at Nimbus, where I grew up, going to watch the salmon come up in the fall. And of course, here, way up this Klamath River. What Peter told me about is I didn't talk to him too much about the Chinook, the planting of these older age Chinook, which is inexcusable as far as I'm concerned, because of the potential effects on the coho. I doubt they did a biological analysis, a biological opinion on that to follow NEPA before they started raising those fish to that older age. But the other thing Peter notices on all these hatcheries is that the steelhead tend to do what's called residualize. Because steelhead are rainbow trout that have just one behavioral difference, they go to the ocean. When you have fish raised this far from the ocean and you have a hatchery that's running year-round with the effluent of the hatchery coming out into the river, the steelhead that get released, they tend to stay right by the hatchery and don't go out to the ocean. And that's one of the reasons why I think the half-pounder run or half-pounder fish down in the lower river are such a fabulous fishery. Is these are larger steelhead that should have gone out earlier, but in some cases in the Klamath River, the steelhead don't go out until they're aged 2 or 3 years old. So you got these really big fish, and for 10 years from 1978, when I moved over to Davis from Berkeley, I happened to meet. I joined the Davis Fly Fishers. I even became the editor of their newsletter because I was an avid fisherman. And I started going with a friend of mine, Kerry Boyden from Sacramento. He lived in Davis and was an attorney over in Sacramento. They'd been fishing the Klamath River since the early 1970s. So from 1978 through 1988, we fished the Klamath from Johnson's Bar downstream. Johnson's about 16 miles downstream from Wichipec, where the Trinity comes in. And we would go down there and fish for these steelhead. And I'll tell you, I just a few years earlier learned how to fly fish. My dad had talked to me about it, but we never did it when we were kids. So I learned this relatively late in life, but I became an avid fly fisherman. And I'll tell you, that fishing down there between Johnson's Bar down as far as Blue Creek is phenomenal steelhead fishing. And this is my biggest concern on dam removal, is the wrecking of that sport fishing opportunity for people to enjoy. Because during the 87 fires, I've told several people this, when we had a very smoky conditions down there, we were choking pretty good. But with no sun on the water, we caught steelhead all day long. I caught 60 steelhead a day there for 3 days in a row over Labor Day weekend. And up to 6 pounds on about a number 12 or 14 brindle bug, you know, with a shooting head on a 4 or 6 weight fly rods. I use Scott rods almost exclusively, the finest rods you can buy. All those sages are just about as good. And I'll tell you, it was better than bone fishing in Christmas Island, 1,900 miles south of Hawaii. It's better fishing than tarpon in the Key West, Florida. It's better than fishing for spring salmon, which are the Chinook up there in British Columbia. It is phenomenal fishing because of the fight of these steelhead. So it's the steelhead that are most interest to me in the river. But anyway, the residualization of steelhead probably is somewhat a result. Tom Wesselow, who was a Caltrout employee until quite recently, stationed over at McKinleyville, told me that unfortunately when they started the hatchery at Iron Gate, they started with rainbow trout and not steelhead. Peter Moyle tells me that steelhead genetics are deeply embedded, so you can still recover the species, but unfortunately the hatchery made a big mistake there on not really having steelhead, but really rearing rainbow trout. And, of course, those guys don't want to go to the ocean at all. And so they probably got a mixed population of rainbow trout and steelhead of what they rear now. And so that is another negative for the coho when you've got all these big steelhead in the river preying on small coho fingerlings. So we're adding up a fairly daunting condition for a listed species. Shouldn't have been listed to begin with. They're cutting the jaw off of all the ones they rear. It's a diseased river, so the cut has particularly high effects. They're raising Chinook to older ages, totally abnormal for any river, which adds predation pressure. And we've residualized the steelhead by probably starting with mostly rainbow trout. And now let me give you the final clincher on this. Until just a couple of years ago, they didn't use any of the jack salmon in any of the breeding programs at Iron Gate Hatchery. Jacks are precocious males, that is, they're, by definition, almost 1 year younger. They're not fully mature, but they do produce sperm. And this is a real biggie, a real big one, even on the Chinook, of why we probably don't have the returns we once had to Iron Gate Hatchery, is by not using jack salmon sperm in their breeding program, which nature had designed as a natural process, that is, these young males coming back with, by definition, not their sisters in the school of fish coming up, because they were reared a year earlier, or a year later than the other females that they are schooling with when they come up the river. So by definition, they're less related genetically. So the choice, another bad choice at Iron Gate Hatchery, was they didn't use any jacks in their breeding program. And and this is where I know a lot about this. This causes what's called inbreeding depression when you're breeding a lot of brother-sister matings. We don't do that in human populations for the most part, although it happens now and then.
we won't go there. That's a different show.
It's not good because it reinforces what are called deleterious genes that are shared among closely related individuals. In other words, your brother, Aaron or Elizabeth, if you have him, they share a lot of the same genes you have. And if you guys were to reproduce, your children would likely have a lot of more problems than you would have if you were to marry and reproduce with a less related individual. So what has happened since 1962 until just a couple of years ago, they were not using any jacks, and therefore they had what's called inbreeding depression. And this causes what are called genetic bottlenecks in the population of fish. And over that 30, 40 years now, the toll has begun to happen. And this is probably a big factor in the decline of the fish in returns to Iron Gate Hatchery. And it takes a while for these deleterious genes to add up and influence the population. What it is every one of us have genetic flaws in our genome. And when you reproduce with a closely related member of your population, those deleterious genes become what are called homozygous, and that means they are expressed in your biology, and some of them are very negative and cause death. So we are probably having a lot of inbreeding depression effects because of lack of use of jack salmon, which are the little males that come along with the females that nature designed them to do a good portion of the breeding so nature could avoid inbreeding depression in schooling species, that is, species that tend to stay together in a community. And so now the importance of jacks was only recently discovered, so we can't really blame that, but we could blame it. We could blame all these other actions on not getting steelhead to start with. They could have done that by looking at otolith measurements on these on the scales of the fish to confirm they came from the ocean. Basically, as I was told by Kim Rushton, the former manager at Iron Gate, the biologists really never came out to help them out unless they had a crisis out there. Basically, the biologists in Fish and Game have treated the hatchery as a foreign party in here, and they don't like the hatchery. So they didn't come out there and help them design their programs, and therefore the fish are suffering. This further helps cause a decline in the fishery now, and this is resulting, and of course now everybody's trying to hang all these problems of these lower returns on agriculture. What a farce.
That's the bottom line, is that every one of these problems ends in it's the ranchers and farmers' fault. We're going to come back with Dr. John Menke in 2 minutes. We're going to talk a little bit about fish screens and fish counts and how those kinds of things work. And then we have a stunning conclusion for you at the end on why hydropower is being eradicated around the country and specifically up there in Siskiyou County. We've got a little sound bite for you, so hang around. We'll be back with you at KCNR 1460 AM, the home of Free Fire Media.
Join the conversation in our chat room, KCNR1460.com.
We the People are watching you. Hey, welcome back to We the People Talk Radio. You know, we're all serious topics, but we try to put our funny spin on it. Hope you like the comedy.
And if you don't, it's too late, because we like it. And it's early in the day for us, and fun's how you get through it.
Serious topics.
Bob's turning us in for fun.
Yeah, we got serious topics. You gotta laugh.
That's right. Okay, so Dr. Menke, we're back with you again on the Coho Salmon here. Talk to folks. We've got not a ton of time left, and I don't want them to miss out on the fish screens and how they count them and stuff, because that also is incredibly stupid.
Yeah, the fish screen program started quite a number of years ago. A lot of people were noticing that when they divert water for irrigation, the fish were coming down their ditches to their irrigation point, and we, of course, don't want to be killing fish. When they first started doing this, there were so many fish coming back that people didn't worry about it much. In fact, some people probably ate the fish and enjoyed them. Since I've lived here since 1993, we haven't had that abundance of fish, and our diversion happens to be above a 22-foot waterfall, so we don't have anadromous fish issues to deal with like most people do. But Fish and Game, in fact, when we refer to their office in Wairika, we always refer to it as a screen shop, because they've had a very capable set of fabricators over there that build these stainless steel, fine mesh screens that have brushes on them that are run by the flow of the water in the ditch by a paddle wheel system that has an arm on it with a crank that will keep the screen clean, with a bypass that puts water, allowing the fish to come down the ditch with the irrigation water and separate the fish off from the water going into the fields for irrigation. And so it's been a very effective program to basically stop any loss of fish in the lead up to your diversion. They're designed lots of different ways, but basically what you have is a takeout from the river or a creek and a ditch coming up to a metal fabricated the paddle wheels, aluminum's to be very light, has a crank on it which has a area maybe 2 feet by 4 feet has a fine mesh screen that the brushes brush off. So any debris that comes down the ditch doesn't plug up the screen, and then there's a bypass flow that goes back to the river itself, so that fish that become entrained, as they call it, in that ditch, they then can pass right out the bypass and have no problem. We've had a combination in Scott Valley. I know the most about either screens being built by contractors or by the screen shop, and they're either installed by Fish and Game and maintained by Fish and Game, or installed by the Resource Conservation District and maintained by them. So it's been kind of a joint effort. It's worked out very well. We basically, any loss of fish have been stopped with these devices. So we have no loss now I think it was relatively minor anyway, but because we haven't seen any big boom in increased numbers after this program was instituted, but with the inbreeding depression and other things that have happened, and also other factors of predation with steelhead on coe and all that kind of stuff, we haven't seen any big benefit of that program, really. But it's more recently it's become a big issue because now that Fish and Game tried to get an incidental take permit program on all diverters in Scott and Shasta Valleys, they started to get more pushy about bypass flows, and they basically are tightening the noose on the diverters, and it all became kind of a mess, even to the point now that there's the Fish and Game has indicated they don't even want to maintain them anymore, or they don't have money to maintain them. So that, I don't know quite where that stands. I don't go all to all the RCD meetings, but the RCD people were getting quite perturbed that after they got all these screens in, then the Fish and Game apparently was pulling out of the program. I don't know how it stands right now, but it becomes somewhat of an issue at times. But largely, the fish screen program works. It's been an excellent program, and they are maintained quite nicely. And there are little hitches here and there, which Aaron knows great detail about a certain fish screen that the Fish and Game has been put in. I, having being approached by so many people now that have fish screens, I think I can see that some of these screens are now purposely being devised so that it's harder for diverters to get their water right. The bypasses are being made larger, so you are losing more of your water. My most recent experience on fish screens was a local rancher wanting to get Fish and Game's help to get the coho out of the lead-up ditch to his fish screen so that he would not be losing any fish when he turns his irrigation water off. It took him forever to get Fish and Game to come out and provide the service that they offer. And then, in fact, when he left the site, they turned his diversion back on again and I think repopulated the ditch with more fish. So the promise to help ranchers is not being fulfilled, and so we're seeing more and more bad faith in the behavior of Fish and Game with their fish screen program. Again, I'm not fully up to date on it, so I shouldn't talk too much, but I am being given information from others about their problems they're having with them. So anyway, a good program if it's managed right, and it does take some money, though, and with tight budgets, things become more difficult.
Well, so just out of curiosity, before they invented fish screens, I mean, didn't the fish figure out that once the water got low and, I mean, weren't there clues that had them turn back? I mean, because you'd think all those years of irrigating, they would have all been dead by now.
Yeah, actually, if you read some of the older documents, some of the old-timer, even the game wardens, indicated that abundant fish populations went right hand-in-hand with abundant agricultural production. We really have had an evolution of the point of view and the motivation and the agendas of employees of all the resource management agencies to the point now that it is really, I'm hoping it's going to reach such a crisis that we start to reverse the biased nature of people and the willingness even not to tell the truth anymore. I'm a scientist. I was trained to search for the truth. That's why I only speak the truth. And I find it more and more in talking with agencies, most of them find it just as easy to not speak the truth as speaking the truth. And you don't get anywhere on problem solving that way, and it becomes extremely costly with no solutions, and it creates a lot of animosity that could easily be avoided.
Well, sure, because people know that they're not being told the truth. They can figure it out. I mean, I think people with... My fish education came from, you know, goldfish at the fair. You know, I mean, I don't have any fish education, and yet in looking at this problem over the last year, just some of the really basic things that we've talked about today, most people kind of add this up and go, this doesn't make any sense. So, well, before we, you know, run out of time and stuff, can we squeeze in the video we're here before our quarter hour break?
Yeah. And there have been a history of putting out weirs on the Scott River, Shasta River, and Bogus Creek, which is the creek that comes in right by the hatchery, to get a count on the fish. And that program ran for a number of years, and actually Kim Rushton, who used to work at the hatchery, the manager, told me about it, that they stopped the program a number of years ago because it was not accurately counting the fish. In particular, like on Scott River, when the flows get so high, the fish can go right over the top of the blockage, the block that they put across the Scott River. And so it does not get typically get a very good count for the coho salmon, which come up later in the fall. Mid November to mid January. Unlike the coho, unlike the chinook that are already coming up. So it disfavored the accurate counting of coho. Well, myself being also a well-trained statistician, because I taught sampling methods and quantitative ecology most of my career, I don't like it when you present data that are not representing the population you're trying to characterize with data. And so if we've got these video weir block where they block the river, a lot of the fish are going over the top and they don't get counted, and agriculture people are wanting to get the count as high as they can, they don't get credit for the fish they're producing then in a place like Scott Valley, which is almost all agriculture. And so when you've got it, and it's particularly a problem on the Scott River, because where they have the video weir at the time of the year when the coho come up, it's quite a big river. Like it's maybe 50 to 60 yards wide, and when my wife and I toured it last year with Morgan Keneckley, who runs the weir program, it was we saw him out there wading out there with a big broom, sweeping off all this. They put out PVC pipe, about 1 inch or 1 1/4 inch PVC, and they cable it to the bottom of the river. And then the pipes hang downstream with the current. And he was out there brushing off this, and they blocked the whole river, 50 to 60 yard wide, and they only give the fish a 6-inch slot to find. He was brushing off the debris, and then he came in and gave us a nice tour. But he gave me his 2009 report that I read carefully on this and other monitoring programs they run, and it indicated that the since they don't see any fish going downstream through the slot, it's not blocking any fish. Well, at that point, a friend of ours from our POW group went down there and actually got a picture of a coho in early January that was hung up in the pipes, and it was hung up in the direction that it was going upstream. It was trying to go over the top, and it got its tail caught. And here it is struggling to try and get up to lay its eggs, and it got caught by the damn video weir. And he also saw all kinds of coho over at one side that were all schooled up below this blocked area. They couldn't find the slot. Well, I better stop there and let's take a break, and we'll finish this up. I've only got a few more points on video weir, but they're biggies.
Okay, cool. We'll be right back with We the People Radio. You're listening to KCNR 1460 AM, the home of Free Fire Media.
You and me go fishing in the dark, lying on our backs and counting the stars where the cool grass grows. Down by the river in the full moon.
This is KCNR, the home of Free Fire Media.
She blinded me with science. She blinded me with science.
When she's dancing next to me. Bob Martin does it again, knocks it out of the ballpark.
Dr. Menke's been blinding us with science for almost 2 hours.
Welcome back to We the People Radio. You're listening to the last 10 minutes. Heading into our anniversary show next week. Don't forget to tune in. You know, with the release of prisoners throughout the state of California, you need to be aware. Join us for Project Taken next Sunday with Cameron Gamble.
Is that a coincidence that they're releasing those prisoners on the anniversary of the show? I think not.
They'll probably be waiting outside for us when we unlock the
door. Is it a coincidence we're talking about maxillary clipping to mark things? I see a crossover. Okay, John, sorry, we're hogging up your time. Fire away.
I just checked the temperature outside. It's still 58 degrees outside, so I'm so happy. The streams are, I'm sure, are cooling today, so the fish ought to be happy. Anyway, I referred to that interim report that Morgan had given me that indicated that the fish were not going downstream through the video weir slot, so therefore it probably was not a problem. For a scientist, that's an absolute red flag. Why in the hell would a coho be going downstream? These fish are doing their best to get upstream to good habitat, to lay their eggs and complete their life cycle and die, for Christ's sakes. I cannot believe a professional person putting that into a report as an indicator that the weir is not blocking fish. We had a tour last January down there with the Yurok biologist, Dave Hillemeyer, and Mike Belchick, and a whole bunch of other people even look at the video weir, and they were taking it out that day, so we didn't see it. But we toured a lot of our good habitat here in Quartz Valley. And Dave Hillemeyer, who has quite a lot of experience in video weirs, I guess, he indicated he had, he said that video weir could be made a lot more fish-friendly. You ought to have more slots in it. You ought to have maybe even use a sonar system. There are sonar procedures that can get a pretty good indication of count. Frank Reitmeier, who worked for the hatchery for years, he says these fish and game guys are always after the numbers. The effect on the fish be damned. And that bothers me a lot because when Tom Pease got the picture of the hung up coho, we went down there and saw the other fish that were being blocked. They couldn't find the slot. They were over on the far side because the people would come over there and stand right by the slot, scare the fish over to the other side. It becomes an attractive nuisance, and so the fish can't get up very well. And anyway, I told Tom, why don't we stop by Don Flickinger's office, National Marine Fisheries, who I know very well, and he did give us 3 minutes, and only three, and he said, I give those guys a Section 7 permit for running that video weir, so they're all permitted up. You know, that's like an incidental take permit, one federal government giving the state an incidental take. Well, I went back home and I started making some phone calls. The first guy I called was Gary Black, who's been running the program on our fish screens and other projects in Scott Valley for years and years. First thing Gary told me, he's seen as many as 70 reds right below the first riffle below the Scott River video weir. Boy, was that ever a red flag to me, because that's real fast water. It's not good coho rearing habitat. And so when those little fingerlings come out of the gravel, they're going to get washed down to the Scott River and die, or get eaten by steelhead or chinook. So I really started to get uppity on this situation. And then I actually talked to Jim Morris, who takes a lot of the high school people out. He's a rancher here and does some teaching at the high school. And they help. He gets the students involved in red surveys. He says he's seen the same thing. And then of all things, since Eric Yokel, who used to work for the RCD, now works for NRCS in Wairika, he told me he's seen the same thing when he came out here and helped us do our red surveys on our ranch last January. And then Preston Harris, who works for the RCD, says he's seen the same thing. Well, nobody was giving this information earlier because everybody was you know, being funded by Fish and Game, and so they weren't spilling the information out as readily as they were, or nobody was asking them the question, or both. So anyway, the upshot of it is we've got a video where it is undercounting the coho, it's blocking coho, and it bothers me particularly because up here in Shackelford Mill System where I live, we have prime coho rearing habitat, and we could use a lot more females up here to spawn. But they can't get here, they can't spawn. So go ahead and package it together, Aaron. This is not a very good set of information we've covered this morning on detrimental effects of success of coho in completing their life cycle. We've got a listed species that should not have been listed. They're maladapted to these warm environments in special areas. We're clipping their jaws. We're maximizing their predation effects of other species on them. And now in the process of counting them, we're making them dysfunctional and completing their life cycle and having access to good habitat. I'm not saying all the fish. We do get some. But everybody here in Scott Valley knows we're spawner limited. We need more spawners up here, guys. Well, I worked with Curtis Milliron, the new fish person there, in when he came to the meeting there at Fort Jones and asked him, could we work with you? Well, I got a very trite letter back from Morgan telling me basically everything's hunky-dory. We're putting the weir in on the 22nd of September, and I asked for a copy of their Section 7 permit. He's not forthcoming with that either. So anyway, we still got a mess here, but we're working on it.
Okay, so now we've added this. You know, we've added all these factors, and of course, I mean, let's face it, it would take a really long time to hit absolutely everything. But I think this has been an awesome overview for people, and at the end of the day, the coho salmon and its endangeredness is one of the big factors to promoting the removal of the Klamath dams.
And you bet it is. In fact, day before yesterday, I actually got two copies through FedEx, which is the executive summary with a big disc in the back, and it probably is another 2,000-page report, which is the EIR-EIS for facilities removal is what they're calling it. They aren't even calling it dams anymore. It's facilities removal. And my wife and I have been thoroughly through the executive summary. We haven't started digging it. We got 60 days to get our comments together. And, of course, we're going to have the big meeting on the 20th of October in Wairika to be able to verbalize our comments in 3 minutes. And you can see how effective I would be in 3 minutes. But anyway, the real glaring point we found in this thing is, can you imagine, I understand now why they want to get the dams out. Section 3.1, Greenhouse Gas Global Climate Change section, proposed mitigation for use of non-renewable fuels. If you aren't aware of it, the Ruby Pipeline has now been put in, almost completed, from Rock Springs, Wyoming to Malin, Oregon. That's going to be the natural gas that they're going to use once the dams get out. And so we're going to be on fossil fuels. Well, CC1, CC2, CC3 is how they're going to take us to the cleaners. They're going to use, these are the proposed mitigation for use of fossil fuels when they get the green power, hydropower taken away from us. Market mechanisms, energy audit programs, and energy conservation plans. They're basically going to price us out of the market by mitigating for greenhouse gases once they get us on natural gas. And that's why they want to take the hydro out.
The smoking gun with 2 minutes to spare. Oh, my gosh. We're going to get some sort of award. Fantastic.
Yep.
And you know what? That's kind of how all this stuff ends. At the end of the day, it's all about getting people off the land. It's all about getting people away from the forest and turning this all back into, you know, some wild habitat.
That's why they call it rewilding.
Yep, it's called very stupid in my book. But, okay, so let's see. We talked fish counts. Can you in 1 minute hit Chuck Bonham's qualifications, the guy from Fish and Game who's their new director now?
Well, I don't know Chuck. Actually, I had a Chuck Bonham on my PhD committee, but it obviously wasn't the same guy. He was a statistician, a range statistician there at Colorado State. I basically remember Jack Ward Thomas when he became the chief of the Forest Service in Washington, D.C., probably the most outstanding ungulate ecologist that ever walked on the earth. He did a fine job, but then they replaced him with more politically oriented leaders in Forest Service, and look where we've gone since that time. Our forests are completely mismanaged. I find it appalling, actually. The public might be interested in knowing that the head of wildlife management for Fish and Game is one of my PhD students, a fine scientist, Dr. Eric Loft. He must be bothered by his job today. Can you imagine having an attorney being your leader? And obviously it means that they're going to try and use the law as their primary procedure to take care of our fish and wildlife in California. What a shame. Our forests are so sterile now that they're not good deer habitat. We aren't getting good water delivery to our streams because we have overly dense forests that are very fire-prone.
Uh-oh.
And Fish and Game used to be promoters of clear cutting and
we're getting the hook
on the ground because they can't fly through the dense forest.
We're getting the hook.
Fox News Radio, I'm Karen Riegel. After 2 years in an Iranian...